Hello and welcome to Talking Finance. I'm Alan Kohler, and Sydney's in lockdown, of course, and there's all sorts of stuff going on in the markets, so there's plenty to talk about. And we've got an excellent lineup for you today. We've got Clifford Bennett, who's an old friend of mine who just spent 6 or 7 years in the Gold Coast doing his own thing and dropped out, really, and now he's back in town, back in Sydney, just in time for the lockdown there, as chief economist at ACY Securities. Clifford will tell us about the CPI number in the US overnight and also his view about inflation and whether it's transitory or not, and in preview, who he thinks it's not. And then Jonathan Payne, who kind of agrees with Clifford. He's the author and publisher of the Payne Report, and he'll talk to us about the markets and the impact in particular of the CPI on the bond yield in America, which has been coming down lately but went up a bit last night. Not much, though. Laura Jays, host of AM Agenda on Sky News, tells us about politics and in particular the latest blue between the federal government and Victoria over the federal government's willingness to help Sydney in its lockdown and unwillingness to help Melbourne and all the rest of the vaccination deal. And speaking of vaccinations, we're talking to Bill Botell, who's an adjunct professor at UNSW and a strategic health policy consultant, he calls himself. Anyway, he's following the health. He's not an expert, he's not an epidemiologist, but he's following all the what's going on very closely, and he brings us up to date on what's going on there and his very strongly held views that the politicians are messing it up. And now here's Clifford Bennett, chief economist at ACY Securities. Well, Clifford, we got US inflation last night, 5.4% for the year. So it seems to be taking off to some extent. Do you think it's transitory, as the Federal Reserve says?
Well, that is the common view. Very, very early on, I could see that we were going to have at least a temporary spike in prices from supply chain disruption. I now have, more recently, completely changed my view. I think we're going to have skyrocketing inflation. I think it's here to stay. I'm calling it a tsunami of inflation, because what's happened is that for 15, 20 years, you had globalization, which for the first time had always been in textbooks, but it hadn't been in the real world, this thing called competitive price pressures. So over the last 15 to 20 years or so, competitive price pressures were a very real phenomenon. And so it didn't matter how strong economies were, you weren't going to have inflation. I remember I forecast there'd be no inflation at the height of the sort of 2008-2009 crisis, when there was all that quantitative easing. People thought we were going to have hyperinflation. I said, no, we're not going to have inflation, because for the first time you have competitive global price pressures. What's happened out of COVID is all of a sudden, a little bit belatedly, but all of a sudden, every business manager around the entire globe, from your local coffee shop to the supermarket to the global corporation, to your car sales yard, everyone's realized that this is an opportunity to raise prices and refatten, if you like, those profit margins that have been so squeezed by global competition. So what's happening is a sort of masking or using as an excuse the supply chain disruptions and the situation of COVID to raise prices and increase profits. So it's kind of a bizarre inflationary outlook, because in the short term, that's going to be good for company profits, because they're regenerating much wider, fatter profit margins for themselves. But over the long term, looking sort of one year, certainly 6 to 18 months out, too high inflation will unravel any good economy over time. So it's a two-sided coin, double-edged sword. In the short term, good for company profits, but a major risk a little bit over the horizon. So inflation is here to stay. It's going to actually get worse, Alan.
What's the evidence for this, Clifford?
Well, I don't know if you've been to your local coffee shop lately, Alan, or maybe someone goes and gets your coffee, but prices are going up everywhere. Buying a new car, prices are through the roof. That's a little bit currency impacted, of course. But you go to your hardware store, anywhere you go, food, for instance, New Zealand, food prices, 6-month high, data out earlier in the week. And just the US inflation number, that core number, is 4.5%. So the headline was 5.4. The core aspect, takes out all the volatile items, was up a whopping 4.5%. Prices are going up and they're going to stay up, and that's going to generate higher wage demands. And we are in an inflationary cycle, I believe.
And what do you think the situation in the Australian economy is at the moment, Clifford?
Well, I think it looks great, doesn't it? I mean, you can't argue with that. I think there's still a lot of underemployment and too high unemployment. But we're just, every time there's a shutdown, of course, there's more stimulus provided from the federal and state government levels. And that will again make the aggregate economic data in Australia continue to look good. My concern, however, is that as what's happened is that we've brought forward this, all this stimulus spending, renovations, etc., has drawn forward out of our future economic activity that would have occurred then, drawn forward into the now, which is going to leave a little bit of a void again 6 to 18 months out from now, when everyone's done all the renovations that are ever going to do over the next few years because of the stimulus support. All the cafes and restaurants we know have renovated and then had continuing problems with shutdowns. So I think, you know, tradies have had a very strong period, and they're a very important part of our economy. They've had a very strong period, but 6 months' time, there may not be any work at all. So I'm not sure the pipeline that's been created can continue to self-generate itself, and that we might have the prospect of some form of economic cliff not too far away from us. We're fast approaching that.
What do you mean by a cliff?
Well, just
apart from yourself.
The economic me. You know, we're already seeing it in US data. Any of the data series you look at in the United States has this distinct rolling over aspect to it. So the absolute numbers are still high because we've come off low bases, a lot of government spending. I mean, US stimulus is the equivalent of 30% of annual GDP, and they're barely back towards 2019 GDP levels. But all the economic data series had that spurt from all that stimulus spending and input, but every data series has this rolling over look to it, aspect to it, which says the party is already over. I mean, the euphoric peak coming out of the pandemic of combined with the stimulus measures, all of that energy, economic energy, is now behind us. And what is in front of us is a period, hopefully, that's normal. But it's going to be less than normal because, again, economic, you know, things, normal people staying at home, they were going to buy a sofa in 2 years' time. They were going to buy a new fridge in 3 years' time or 1 year time, 1 year's time. Everyone's done all of that activity, consumption, in the last 6 to 12 months, which means there's going to be a dearth of fresh economic stimulus, certainly, but even consumer and business investment 6 to 18 months out. Now, at the moment, businesses are seizing on the idea of greater profit margins and still benefiting from the stimulus spending that's already occurred, plus there's going to be more in New South Wales now. But I think there's just too much extrapolation of what's happened in the last 6 months into the future without recognizing that this was a huge surge that is already peaked and diminishing, and we should be a little bit more cautious about our future economic outlook.
Thanks, Clifford.
Thanks
great to talk
very much,
to you. Simon.
Thank you.
Now here's Jonathan Payne, trader and publisher of the Payne Report and author of books as well. Jonathan, what are we learning from the US 10-year bond market? I mean, it's been falling lately, but what did it do last night when the US inflation numbers came out?
Well, initially, obviously the CPI number was, quite a bit above expectations, well, materially above expectations. So you had a kind of knee-jerk reaction in the US bond market where yields rose, bond prices fell. But then in a very, very short period of time, that was reversed. However, by the end of the trading session, overnight, we saw US bond yields rise about 4.5, maybe 5 basis points all in all. So, Yeah, really, I suppose in a way, quite a muted reaction to what was, you know, an undeniably very, very significant rise in consumer price inflation.
More or less in line with what the bond market's been doing for a couple of months. What do you make of that, the falling yield?
Well, it's, you know, this is the fascinating thing, isn't it? Gee whiz, it's kind of complex to unpick the market's reaction function with regard to economic data, because the market is also trying to interpret what the US central bank's reaction function is. So in a normal world, strong growth accompanied by higher than anticipated inflation would mean, all things equal, that bond yields rise. And that's how we've all been raised to believe that's the way that markets respond to those types of macroeconomic forces. However, now that the US Central Bank appears to be saying to the market that it isn't going to allow inflation to run as hot as we had previously anticipated, we've seen what's called basically a flattening in the US yield curve, because the market has begun to price US short-term rates being raised earlier than previously expected. So bottom line is the market's response now is that if inflation continues to rise, the Fed, the US Central Bank, will raise rates earlier than they had anticipated 6 months ago. So it's a very convoluted process of thinking about how the markets respond. But, Alan, my view is that the Fed's view on inflation and the market's overwhelming consensus that inflation really isn't anything to be worried about, I think that is misplaced. And obviously, this whole debate centers around this notion of whether or not inflation in the United States is transitory.
So the big debate in the equity market is whether the reflation trade is dead or not. So I gather from what you're saying that it's not.
Well, my view is that inflation is going to, well, it's already risen far more sharply than anyone, any of the major economists had anticipated. I mean, obviously, overnight, we saw the headline CPI number in the United States reach a year-on-year annual rate of change of 5.4%. So, you know, that's significant. And also the core CPI rising at an annual rate of 4.5%, which is the highest since 1991. Now, in my view, the transitory narrative is predicated upon the expectation that, first and foremost, the Fed will act to suppress inflation if it starts getting out of control. And moreover, due to the so-called base effects, that many of these one-off factors, such as used car prices, which we know have risen very, very sharply, and the reopening phenomenon, once that passes through, that inflation is going to gravitate back to levels near 2% at the end of 2022. I actually think, first and foremost, that inflation is rising much more sharply than anyone anticipated, and I think will be more persistent than the current consensus anticipates. So that's where I sit in terms of the whole inflationary debate. In terms of this whole arena of reflation, clearly we're seeing a very, very powerful reflationary macroeconomic environment, because we have unprecedented monetary policy stimulus coupled with unprecedented fiscal policy stimulus. So the policy framework, Alan, that we're experiencing today, none of us have ever experienced before. I mean, it's unprecedented. By definition, we haven't experienced it before. And moreover, and I think it's a point that the markets possibly underestimate, is that we have an administration, the Biden administration, that has the most progressive policy mix that we've seen. So all of these things together, combined with a strong banking system, tells me that, in fact, inflation will remain higher for longer than the market currently anticipates.
This may even be before your time, Jonathan, but in the 1960s, we saw the Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and the War on Poverty. Prior to that, there was the John F. Kennedy spending on technology.
Yes.
in some recent columns that I've been doing, I've been comparing what Biden's doing to that.
Yes.
Do you think that there's an analogy there between the inflation that occurred in the 70s, the late 60s and 70s, and what might happen now, in the sense that part of the inflation of the 70s may have been caused by the fiscal policies of both Johnson and Kennedy?
I think they are very analogous in a number of respects, and we don't need to go through the detail, but as you say, Johnson's Great Society, highly stimulatory environment. Then, of course, you know, we ran into, the Vietnam War, which, and then we had Nixon thereafter. But, you know, to me, Biden is certainly one of the most progressive presidents we've seen in a very, very long time. And also, I believe the most influential people in his party, namely characters such as Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, these are people on a mission and in a hurry to implement the most progressive policies that we've seen in a very, very long time. And it is my view that that wing of the Democratic Party really doesn't care if inflation is 3 or 4 or even 5%. Their mission is to, first and foremost, restore the country to full employment, but also address some of the, you know, the extraordinary inequities in society. And they're on a mission and in a hurry because, of course, they've got the midterm elections coming up.
Yeah. What do you think the net impact of all this is on equities, in the sense that you've got, you know, the spending, the government spending is likely to be positive for the economy and for stocks. But on the other hand, perhaps there's inflation coming, which will lead to higher interest rates earlier than expected.
Right. Well, that's the trade-off, is it not? So unambiguously positive for growth are both the fiscal and monetary stimuli, unambiguously. However, the price that will be paid for that quantum of stimulation will be higher prices, all things equal. And don't forget, we also have a banking system that is in very, very robust shape. So a lot of the debate recently has been, we had very significant monetary stimulus following the GFC 2008, and that didn't translate into higher inflation. I'm afraid that argument is very, very flawed. Because, of course, it forgets that the banking system in 2008 was bust, not just in the United States, but in Western Europe as well. And the banking system is really, in essence, the transmission mechanism. And if your transmission mechanism or engine room is bust, you don't get a translation from monetary policy into real economic activity. This time, of course, everything is firing on all cylinders. The banking system is strong. Fiscal stimulus is strong, as is monetary policy. Therefore, we're going to see inflation rising more than we have witnessed in a very, very long time. And then, of course, to make it even more complex, you have the big geopolitical phenomena, such as deglobalization, the decoupling between the United States and China, the ramifications for supply chains, so on and so forth. So the debate is a complex one. And I'm leaning more towards the net consequence of that confluence of forces leading to higher inflation, notwithstanding, Alan, that clearly we have on the other side very, very high levels of debt, which will serve to suppress economic activity. We have the technological revolution, digitalization, so on and so forth. So that's really the kind of, the balance of the argument. Here and now, I see inflation surprising to the upside. And as we know from history, inflation is like gravity for financial assets because, of course, it raises the discount rate. So that's the kind of balancing act that we're trying to undertake at the moment.
Wonderful to talk to you, as always, Jonathan. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan.
Members on my right will cease interjecting. The Leader of the House will cease interjecting.
And now here's Laura Jays, host of AM Agenda on Sky News. Laura, Scott Morrison's been under siege over vaccinations and the slow rate of them. Do you think that the support he announced yesterday for New South Wales, for Sydney, will get him out of the poo?
Well, not exactly, but it was a long time coming and he needed to do it. So the speed in which he has done this, probably a little bit slow, but businesses don't care about the politics, as you know, Alan. They just want to see this money support them through tough times, through no fault of their own. These people aren't running bad businesses. They're forced into lockdown. And CBDs, particularly in Sydney, is an absolute ghost town. So finally, this money has come. It's different to a JobKeeper. It's a little bit more complicated. It essentially does the same thing. There's that nexus that stays between business and employees, which was so important. So people can't be sacked. So there is a bit of politics in all of this. They didn't want to go back to a JobKeeper because that was a scheme that they said was temporary. It was targeted and it was never going to come back. So they're now talking about this new support. It's called the Business Support Package as a timely announcement. And it will be temporary as well. It'll last the length of the lockdown. But if you're listening from Victoria, you'll note that you didn't get this. Well, the difference there that the politicians are saying is that, well, Victoria wasn't a long lockdown. It was only a couple of weeks. And there's a very different situation here in Sydney.
Well, the other difference, of course, is that the Victoria has a Labor government and New South Wales has a Liberal government.
That's right. And the Prime Minister is a Sydney politician, but Josh Frydenberg is a Victorian politician as well. So we can't forget all of that. He would have known the situation on the ground there. And you're right, Alan, to talk about the politics in all of this. We've seen, you know, some kumbaya moments in National Cabinet. But then when they leave that virtual room, things seem to fall apart. And the Victorian Premier, through an unnamed spokesperson, it should be said, did not miss. He said, we're sick of scrapping over money and begging for support from the federal government. But look, if this happens to Victoria, rest assured that if you do go into an extended lockdown now, you will also get this support. So not completely blind to the politics there and the seats that the federal government needs to win at the next election, which is not too far away, by the way.
No, so how do you think Scott Morrison and the government is travelling in relation to that election?
I hate to sound like a broken record, but it's all down to the vaccine rollout. And, you know, looking at the timing and how this all might line up, it might just work for him because an election needs to be called by the very latest May of next year. The vaccine rollout is painfully slow at the moment. We've got ads telling people to go out and get vaccinated who are not eligible yet because we don't have enough vaccine supply. But that will change. That will change eventually. Even though you've seen this early stuff up, down the line, we are going to start to get 1 million vaccines a week. That'll go up to 2 million and people will get it. So it might all line up for Scott Morrison. And I think in the end, Alan, people have got really short memories. So if it's all going well in the beginning of next year, we're vaccinated, we get to see our loved ones for Christmas, the economy is opening up, there might even be a hint of overseas travel, I think all will be forgiven because the thing is you have to remember that this is a crisis. And while Scott Morrison isn't going to be rewarded at the moment, I don't think Labor have given a big, bold, bright alternative as to what it would do. And I think people are a little bit, you know, they're a bit demoralised at the moment. Whilst they want to see governments held to account, they also want to see solutions and a bit of positivity that brighter days ahead.
So short memories, eh? That's interesting. Yeah. So,
don't you?
Yeah, look, most of the time. I just remember, I think Labor got sacked in 96 because of the recession that was by then, I don't know, 4 years old. So
yeah, maybe that's not really interesting because it all depends how the economy is bubbling along as well. And we keep on hearing from politicians how good we've got it. You know, the employment rate is 5.1%. The economy is growing. It's doing better than the rest of the world. And I might boldly suggest that some people just aren't feeling it because they haven't got a significant pay rise in a long time. They also are not getting the hours they want at work. So whilst the statistics are good and politicians have a good story to tell about those headlines, I think maybe there is a bit of fatigue about people being told how good it is when they're not feeling it.
Yeah. Well, you're right, though. We'll see what happens next year. Thanks very much, Laura.
Thanks, Alan.
And now here's Bill Bartel, who is an adjunct professor at UNSW. Well, Bill, how long do you think this Sydney lockdown will go for from here? It's already 2.5 weeks or so old.
Well, it will go longer if the New South Wales government cannot resolve the internal fight they're having between those people who think that the economy, whatever that means, is paramount over public health. We have to go to stage four lockdowns of the sort that have worked in Melbourne, New Zealand, Brisbane, Perth, because they are the only things that work. We ought to have gone into that hard and sharp lockdown as soon as possible after the first case was detected, when COVID Delta drove right through the defences at Sydney Airport. If we'd done that, I'm pretty sure by now we would have been out of it and this would be a memory. But if they keep persisting with this quasi-lockdown and don't tackle people moving around greater metropolitan Sydney, that is by closing the big business retailers, the construction sites, posing kilometre distance, putting outdoor masks there, then the view of our most eminent epidemiologists, Brendan Crabb at the Burnet Institute, Tony Blakely in Melbourne, Sharon Lewin at the Doherty, is that this could drag on indefinitely.
Right. So what we have now is stage three lockdowns in Sydney, right?
Well, we have a lockdown that's dictated, frankly, by the interests of a very few private sector people who put their own position ahead of the public interest. Now, it has been confusing. We had a lockdown light at the beginning of this. Right at the beginning, you might remember, they were thinking about confining the virus to local government areas. Well, that was news to the virus. That came and went within a day. But then we struggled on with people, a lot of people, frankly, not appreciating the gravity of the situation. Because on the one hand, the Premier was saying this is extremely serious and Delta's all new and a game changer, which it is. But on the other hand, saying don't worry about going shopping. I mean, well, you can go shopping. Please don't browse. Now, that's the most extraordinary piece of non-scientifically based flim-flam you could possibly imagine. It's a political response to a public health emergency. If politics gets in the way of running this any further, the situation in Sydney will decline even more rapidly than it is at the moment.
A lot of the political leaders, I think including Gladys Berejiklian, but I can't swear to this, have been trying to persuade people that we need to live with COVID-19, that, you know, the zero COVID strategy won't work long term. That's right, isn't it?
Look, Alan, by October last year, thanks to the mobilisation of the people, the great dedication of the public health system, the leadership shown by the premiers, including Gladys Berejiklian at that time, and the territory ministers, and the inspiration of Jacinda Ardern, you know what happened in Australia by October last year? COVID was over. It was gone, as in New Zealand, as in China, one of the few countries that achieved such a miraculous and wonderful thing. Fantastic. Now, it was sustainable in the way that we'd organised ourselves with borders, but the deal the Australian people thought they were in was that the Australian government would get on with it, order the vaccines that were required to start vaccinating Australia en masse from January 2021, like every other comparable country did, and that they would upgrade the borders and the quarantine arrangements against the emergence of Delta. Now, I was one of many, but many better people than I did pleaded with them, upgrade the quarantine. The thing spreads in air. The thing is very dangerous and it's getting out of control around the world, running rampant around the world. They did nothing. Now, it was sustainable. It is sustainable. COVID zero is the only policy we can adopt now until we get 80% plus of Australians fully vaccinated. Now, had that been the case by June the 30th, we would have had options. We would have been able to handle this in a far more methodical and joined up way than the present chaos in Sydney. Now, that's the uncomfortable truth. The people who talk about living with COVID, they really mean dying with COVID. Look at the hospitalizations in the United Kingdom going through the roof. All the countries that have tried to have a political fix against COVID Delta are falling to pieces because their system, you know, the politics just doesn't matter to the virus. So we achieved a great deal here. And rather than it being undermined, as it has been, by interests around the federal government and the preposterous belief in New South Wales that they had got a gold standard different way of doing things, it would have been very much better for this country if there'd been a bit of humility, a bit of willingness to learn, a bit of understanding that maybe they had called it wrong, and certainly if there had been a lot more activity to give us both the shield of upgraded quarantine that was resistant to or proof against Delta, and what I'd call the sword or the needle of vaccinating all Australians in a real race against the mutations of the variants.
But to be clear, Bill, you're saying that until we achieve herd immunity through vaccination, we've got to pursue zero COVID and lockdown hard whenever there's an outbreak.
Look, I'm not an epidemiologist or a doctor, but I take great notice in the advice of people who are. Now, we've got to get up to something like 80%. There is a figure. But even when we get there, and then we want to open up so that people can come and go across the borders and hopefully not COVID Delta or whatever variant comes along next year, that will take a lot of methodical thought and preparation. Very importantly, I would say we should issue a white paper. Remember those? Where all of the options and the assumptions are put out so the Australian people can debate and understand what is being proposed by the governments of Australia. Because, mark my words, it'll be the businesses and the people who will pay with their jobs, their health, and regrettably their lives if this has got wrong. Now, policy at federal level in the last 18 months has gone around like a pinball in a pinball machine. Whether it's vaccinations, whether it's aerosol transmission, whether it's quarantine arrangements, whether it's living with COVID or back to COVID zero or near as possible to COVID. I mean, really, this is not the way that a sophisticated, rich country should be run any further. It is time for the people and, truthfully, the business people, the business people with the interests of the country at heart, to assert themselves and to demand that the next phase of this is done with the debate, consideration, with the contestability, and with everything out there on the table, honestly and truthfully, so that we can figure out as a country how to get to the stage we all want, fully vaccinated, able to come and go, but trying to maintain, if not, you know, zero COVID every day all the time. And it's never been the assumption that you could maintain that. You would have to have some very effective processes in place so that when COVID or the next variants got out, we'd be able to smash it down fast and clobber it and still have the advantages of travel and greater involvement. Now, that was on the table from last October. Now we're almost a year into it. And look at the chaos. The beating heart of the Australian economy has gone into cardiac arrest. People are being laid off all over Sydney. Businesses are being smashed. And beyond that, the strains on our hospital system, if COVID were to go up in hospitalisations here like in the UK, would be immense. Not just because of the health impacts of people with COVID, but of course you cripple the ability of the hospitals. And it's got to be said, the medical GP system to look after all the other cases, you know, the ordinary cases that turn up in our hospitals and fill them 100% every day anyway. So there is no joined up thinking going on. You've got the economic ministers in New South Wales evidently fully across the idea that we've just got to live with COVID, whatever that means. You've got the public health people, Dr. Chant and others, who, of course, completely understand what's at stake and wish to do it. And you've got this fight going on between these two factions while everybody else in Sydney, 5 million people, are going out backwards and no end in sight.
We'll have to leave it there, Bill.
And not Thanks. A way to run a railroad, Alan, in my view.
No, I can hear that. Good on you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
It's Bastille Day, July the 14th, the storming of the Bastille. So let's have a bit of Francais and Edith Piaf singing Je ne regrette rien. That was my hopeless French. But here she is, the little sparrow.
Non, rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien. Ni le bien.
That's it. Thanks for listening. See you next week.